for those of you who have only listened to the podcast and may not know, we are radio hosts. That's the day job. And this podcast is a product of that radio show, so we can dig a little deeper. And one of the things that always comes up during the show is this era of Christian music. We refer to it as the golden era. There was something about the 90s in Christian music. It was like the Wild West. There was so much variety. There was this explosion of music. So when we heard there's a book coming out called Mixtape Theology focusing on 90s CCM, we knew we needed to talk about it. And not just talk about the music, but let's take a look at the theology of 90s CCM. This is Consider It Joy.
Consider it pure joy.
See if it sparks joy in you.
Because you know the testing of your faith produces perseverance.
If anybody's listened to this show for a while now, or even our radio show, you probably heard us rant on this before. The golden era of Christian music was unequivocally... did I use the word right?
Yeah, sure.
It's in the 90s. And this is when, you know, the music scene had exploded and there was this variety and this creativity and this depth that was out there. But what about when it comes to the theology that came with this music scene? And so today we're excited to talk to a couple of people about this. There's a new book that just came out called Mixtape Theology. Ashley Mofield, or Dr. Ashley, and Rachel Cash, both here, authors of the book. You guys, thanks for being able to join us on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks. We're excited to be here.
I like the idea of mixtape theology, the idea of just taking songs from the 90s, Christian music, and giving like a better spiritual context of it. Like, what was that song talking about? What made you want to write a book about it?
Well, you know, mixtape theology is a practice. It's something that I've always done since I discovered Christian music. My first entrance into Christian music, contemporary Christian music, was Stephen Curtis Chapman's The Great Adventure album. And if you've ever opened up his liner notes, do you remember liner notes?
Yeah,
those little paper things that have all
back,
the lyrics.
Back in the day.
Back in the ancient times.
And has a great smell to it, by the way, when it's brand new.
Oh, yeah. You ain't kidding.
Nothing like it. That smell of the ink. Anyway, his liner notes would include the scriptures for his songs. I don't know if that's like the inspiration for his songs, but anyway, I would look up the scriptures for those songs and I would learn a lot of theology just from exploring his liner notes and those verses. And that's something that I kept doing. So anytime there was a new Christian song that I was interested in, I would try to find the Bible verses that might have inspired that song. And I would include those Bible verses alongside my little mixtapes that I would create for myself or for my friends. So I'd have like a whole little library of songs and their verses that went with it. So I'm 42 now, and I just thought it would be a really fun idea to put this into a book and to kind of re-examine the theology that I looked at back when I was a teen, and how has it grown and how has it changed now? I still love this music just as much as I did back then. So it's been a really awesome and fun thing to do. And so then I asked my pastor, which you guys know is Dr. Ashley, and I asked him, hey, would you like to come alongside and do this with me? Because actually he does the same thing that I do, except he does it in his sermons. So it just seemed like a great partnership for us to do this together.
So let me ask something just before we get too ahead of ourselves. So we're talking a little bit about this idea of theology in music, specifically in 90s CCM music. But like in the book, before you even get to theology, you got mixtape. So some people don't even know what we're talking about with the mixtape. Mm-hmm. I want to know, did you guys make the mixtapes back in the day? And
of course.
Mixtapes just for you? Or was this like the mixtapes, you know, when you had that love interest and you'd make them that tape with all the love songs?
You know, I think it's a little of both. I mean, yeah, we had the mixtapes with our girlfriends. We had the mixtapes with our favorite Christian artists. I go back as far as having a cassette tape and listening to the radio,
yes,
waiting for my favorite song to come on
and recording
to push record. Yeah. So then I could, you know, and I don't know if there was anything illegal or legal about what I was doing, but
the
make a mixtape from the radio, from my cassette recorder. And that's big time throwback. But yeah, absolutely.
I remember
it's a lost art.
There was a time, I'm sorry, Rachel, there was a time, but on the radio when they would say something about, hey, we've got that new song coming up. You know, the new DC Talk song, it's happening right here. And so you'd wait for it. Yep. And sometimes right. It would be the radio station that would drag it along. And we are totally guilty of that. We do it on purpose
in
sometimes.
5 minutes, now yeah. In 10 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets longer as it goes.
Right.
And that's exactly what you're waiting for. You have like record and pause both pressed on mine. Right. So you could release pause and grab it. And usually on those mixtapes, the beginning of that track, you'd have just like, it is by DC Talk, you know, from the DJ right. That would catch on there.
Well, and the worst would be when the DJs, no disrespect to you guys, Matt and Aaron, but would start talking at the end of the song. So you couldn't just get a clean recording of
yes.
It. Like, let it finish. Don't talk over it. The song's got a great ending, but I know y'all got to do your thing too. So that was just part of it.
I'm just curious. So yeah, that's the mixtape part of it. But why the 90s? What was it? What is it for you guys? Not that we're older. I'm 44. Sure. I believe that this is the definitive era for Christian music. There's definitive eras for things, but I think this is the biggest, broadest era for Christian music for me. But what is it for you guys that wanted to do it, focus on this decade?
Well, I think it starts with, like, it was the soundtrack of an important part in our spiritual journey. And I'm a little older than Rachel. And I do agree, it is the golden era of Christian music, of contemporary Christian music. And we just happened to be blessed of growing up in a time where we were growing in the Lord. We were getting involved in our youth groups. I was feeling called to ministry. So it's kind of, I graduated in 1992. So the beginning of my high school or the end of my high school years, when I was aware that this music was out there, then going to college, then feeling called to ministry, then going to seminary. It's like these songs not only are really good, they're the soundtrack of so much of like the most important times of my own spiritual journey. So it's really easy to reflect on them and think, man, when I hear that song, it takes me to a place of a mission trip or, senior year of high school or my first year of seminary. And then to think about where I was spiritually then and then how I've grown in my theology. You know, that's something that we do in the book. Like, there's some things that I thought I had figured out in 1994 that I've grown a lot. And so it's fun to do this practice again and listen to a song that I loved and see, all right, I got that right. Or, wow, there was more to that song than I even realized back then.
You know, Rachel, Ashley is your pastor. So did you get this connection? Like, he knows the same music I do. Because he's quoting the lines in his sermon from songs. Is that how you picked it up?
Well, you know, I had been going to the same church as Ashley for a long time, but there was one Sunday where he did a sermon. It was entitled The Great Adventure. I mean, come on, you guys. I knew that I loved the church already, but at that point, I'm like, okay, this is really something special.
He's like, all right, guys, saddle up your horses. We're going.
Yes, and that is yeah. The sense of humor that Ashley has. Like, that is real life. If you read in the book, the cheesy, funny stuff in the book that comes from him, like, that is not an act. That is truly the cheese that just flows through him. In fact, Ashley does a lot of the memes. So we found a new spiritual gift, and it is making memes, and Ashley has it.
It's definitely a gift.
You know, and the crazy thing about thinking about my sermons, I mean, I'm an expository preacher. We go through books of the Bible, but right now I'm going through the book of John, and I just can't go through a sermon in a particular passage and like, wow, that makes me think of this song, or it's just so much a part of who I am. So it's not like I'm doing these topical sermons on 90 songs, even though that's what the book is. But on Sunday mornings, I'm preaching through a book of the Bible. It just kind of comes out, and Rachel saw that we had that in common and approached me.
I see you getting into the Lazarus part, and you're like, Lazarus, come forth. I'm breaking into Carmen.
Oh, I break out into song all the time.
Yeah, you have to. You know, one of the things I think you kind of talked, Ashley, about the fact that there's a certain nostalgia that comes with, you know, and I think everybody has that. No matter what era of music you grew up with, you have the nostalgia sure. factor that takes you to a time and a place. But
another time, another.
Sorry, that's right. That's right. And Aaron and I, though, we've for a while kind of went back and forth on this thing because we both, as we got to know each other and stuff, had the same ideas. 90s were the best part of music for the Christian music world. And but I started thinking, OK, is it all nostalgia? Because everybody, it's like, oh, the dads that still love Zeppelin, they don't make it like that anymore. Right. That kind of thing. So we started asking. And we've spent years now, not just talking to artists that are more recent, but ones that have been around a long time, and asking them that question, saying, are we just skewed? Is this, are we on nostalgia or was there something else? And every single one of them, they'll say, oh, no, 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 no. That was a pivotal period. That wasn't just nostalgia. It really was different throughout the 90s. And, you know, maybe it was late 80s, early 2000s, but in that 90s window, where we had this explosion of music and we haven't had anything quite like it before. And really we haven't had anything quite like it since. And there's, you know, there's always the waves in music, but I think it's important to point out to anybody that wasn't around that music or that era, it's not just a bunch of old people right now reminiscing about the good old days. There actually were songs and albums and moments that completely changed the industry and the sound, and it happened repeatedly. And that's one of the reasons I think this whole era is so fascinating.
So I'd say also why your book is taking off right now, Mixtape Theology, because it plays out like a devotion with the biggest songs of that decade. And some of the songs that are like, weren't even the biggest ones, but were pivotal into what you were either listening to, or I want to say even watching, because you guys point out in your book, not just the song lyrics, but you even point out the music videos.
Right. Yeah. That's kind of a lost art compared to what it was in the 90s as well. The creativity and the things that were happening with the videos for sure.
Yeah. I think too, that the 90s was unique in that it focused specifically on reaching the youth. I think that was something that started like in the Jesus music, like, you know, aspect is reaching the young people. I mean, you think of all the songs and the, you know, even Stephen Curtis Chapman trying to do that with songs like Got to Be True. But we have people like Carmen and Al Denson, Audio Adrenaline, DC Talk, who their focus was on reaching and encouraging the youth. You know, Audio Adrenaline had AKA Public School, you know, songs that were specifically for young people. And that really spoke to us, our generation. We felt included as part of this like big club, this subculture club of 90s Christian music. I feel like that might be a little bit lost today. You know, there's not that ownership feeling that young people have about the Christian music today, at least what I've observed.
That's a great point. I remember in our youth room, we would put up the little squares from the Christian bookstore when there'd be an album release. I'd be the guy who would go in there because, they'd have the extra posters and they were like those 12 by 12 squares. The album
I had every Rebecca St. James poster.
Yeah. And I would get, so I'd keep mine. Right. And then we'd put them up in the youth room, but you're right. It was such a youth focus. Like we had a whole wall of them and all these different albums. And I don't know that any youth group has current Christian, you know, album covers up on the wall.
Well, and just the risk taking in a healthy way, the musicianship, the creativity, the artistry, I wrote a devotion on Newsboys Shine, and you're not going to hear a song like that on the radio right now. Like you pull out the lyrics to that song, and that's just one of many. And so it was a special time. And so when we set out to do this book, we really didn't think we were the only ones, just like you, that thought this. And I think that's a reason why the book is doing so well right now. You know, if we would have just been in love with 80s Christian music, there's an audience for it. But I don't know that there's quite the audience that we're finding right now with this book. And so it's 90s, super exciting.
90s is so unique because you have this is where rap comes into play.
Right.
So words can be different. But then pop music changes because of rap. And then you get a band called DC Talk that jumps in here. And I bring that band up because you make a statement at the bottom of your book, like back what was then and this is now. You write what was then DC Talk, this is now blank. there is no a difference, but because they were able to go from that level from rap to pop to rock to whatever it needed to be to reach the youth. And that, and they were the band that was about youth.
But I don't even feel like DC Talk was about the youth. DC Talk was about the art. They were artists with three very distinct forms of that art. And that blend, which somehow shouldn't have worked and did, and all these diverse, radically different styles from each of them made it so unique. You know, they weren't the band out there making youth group music. They weren't KJ52. They were doing something, you know, I guess just so unique and so special. But they weren't the only ones. A lot of artists were doing that. So I'm curious from you guys, though. I want to talk. So the book is a devotional, like you mentioned, and much of the focus is taking these songs and then taking the scripture behind them, kind of taking a theological approach. As you look back and we're kind of geeking out about all these old songs, did you ever come across any that were like, oh, you know what other song was big? This one. But oh, yeah, let's not use that one. Did you have those moments?
Absolutely.
What's a song?
What
are some of the songs?
Well, you know, we did prayerfully have to pray through, okay, we're going to choose 35 songs. That means there's songs that are left out that are some of our favorites.
Yeah.
We wanted to get a diverse group represented. Like, you know, I mean, Rachel and I probably could have done a devotional just on Stephen Curtis Chapman and DC Talk songs and done 35 devotionals on that and thrown a Jars of Clay song in there and been thrilled, but that wouldn't have had a wide appeal. And even Rachel and I, our tastes are a little different. Like, I was on the softer side. Like, I was more into For Him, where Rachel was more into Switchfoot. And I we balanced. Like, there's some songs that she wrote devotions on. Like, well, you know what? I really wasn't that big a Switchfoot fan. And now that I've done this devotion with Rachel, yesterday I was on the way to school with my 10-year-old daughter jamming out to Switchfoot. It's like I'm discovering stuff. They're like, how did I miss New Way to Be Human? This is a really, really good song. And I'm still jamming out to For Him, and Rachel may not care anything about For Him. I don't know. But, yeah, she's shaking her head no. I'm trying to think of songs. You know, like, there's some that had to go in. They were so monumental, like Big House. That was one that I almost didn't want to do because, all right, we're going to dig into the theology. All right, that just seems like a silly youth group song. Like,
yeah.
I literally, in college, like, saw a puppet show to Big House. Nothing says 90s Christian music like, you know, a puppet show.
Yes.
With the puppets throwing footballs and dancing around. And like, all right, there's nothing deep about that. And so I was even like, you know what? This just probably doesn't need to make the cut. And like, well, how can you tell the 90s story without Audio Adrenaline and Big House? And then the fun part of it was, as I began to study and look at John 14, and he goes to prepare a place for us, and really peel back even what the intention of Mark Stewart was, and even did research in his own book, like, okay, I think I can write a devotion on this. So maybe that's not really, I'm not answering your question, but like, that's one that almost was on the cutting table that was like, I don't know.
You know? Well, I will say that, you know, DC Talks, I Wish We'd All Been Ready is a hot topic, eschatology. Yeah. We try to not touch that with a 10-foot pole. Anything that might be divisive theologically, or it might be from someone that might cause a debate, like, we're not interested in that. We just want people to have a good time and focus on the Bible and not get distracted by who the song is from or, you know, a hot take. We're not trying to do any hot takes or anything like that.
No, I'm curious because you have like Big House. And besides, I Wish We All Been Ready was still Larry Norman from the 70s. So you could push by that one. But like, the theology of the kingdom, it's like your first section. That's where you put Big House at. But not at the end, where you have theology of the new heaven and the new earth. What makes the distinction for that on where you place it?
Well, you know, as I really did a lot of studying on John 14, I mean, just we could talk theology. Yeah, the song is about heaven. But, you know, in the 90s, there was a classic worship song that we all sang, Sanctuary. And like, we are the sanctuaries. We're the house. God's kingdom, you know, we start off with heaven in the real world. Now, God's kingdom on earth right now. We're not just waiting for heaven for a big, big table and football. Like his, we are his dwelling place right now. And so that's why we thought that works up front. And of course, we brought it home with another time, another place. And, you know, we had our eschatological songs there in the last part of the devotion. But that's a great question.
So you have these different segments in the book. The segments, we talk about theology of kingdom. There's theology of sin, salvation, surrender, prayer, evangelism, Holy Spirit, and then new heaven, new earth. What decided these are the sections we're going to cover?
Rachel, do you want to answer it? I mean, I've got an answer to that, but go ahead.
It's not like we did it intentionally. We just kind of realized that there were some common themes here. And so we just created some common themes to kind of help people to think in, you know, chunks.
Yeah, this is not intended to be a systematic theology, like, all right, we've got to hit every theological concept. So let's come up with our table of contents and then fit songs. We picked the songs and then thought, all right, where do these fit? And so there's things that we don't talk about because we just, they weren't in the songs we chose. So that'll be in volume two.
Ah, there is a volume two.
Hey, man, we're not ready.
Of this, I think.
Because I'm curious, like, actually, there's got to be songs in here that you wish you covered it for, like, after you put out the 35.
Yeah.
Like, oh, no. Yeah. You know what? We should have led with this one instead.
Well, you know, we're praying about the next steps. Maybe there's a volume two. Maybe there's something else. I don't know. You can join us in praying for that.
So you're talking, you know, of course, in this case, you've got a book, you're doing the wide appeal thing, but let's talk about, it's 1998. Okay. You've got one of those visors, one of those CD sleeves on the visor of your car, the kind you flip down. What CDs do we find in it in your cars?
Well, in 1998, I was all about Caveman's Call. I was in seminary, and that's probably around 40 Acres. I think their first album was 96, 97. 40 Acres might have been 98, 99. So I was probably listening to Caveman's Call. I was probably listening to Stephen Curtis Chapman's Speechless. I was probably still listening to Jars of Clay 1995 album and their follow-up album and wearing those out. And just the top of my head, that's where I go.
Yeah.
Rachel, what about you?
So mine would be Rebecca St. James, Out of Eden, Lisa Bevel, DC Talk. But Stephen Curtis Chapman, who is my absolute favorite, has his own little CD case. So his little CDs don't touch the rest of the CDs.
I look at your guys' song, your artists, some of the stuff that you guys write in here. And there is an artist in there. I was a little bit let down, like I wanted to see Eric Champion. You reference him in a quiz, but like.
I love Eric Champion. We do have a podcast too. And we've covered one of his songs, Droppin' Nova, which I absolutely love. It's one of
great
my
album,
most favorite songs.
Album.
Yeah. I love Eric Champion to death. He's one of my favorites. But yeah, I mean, it hurt every time we had to, you know, cut, you know, made some choices. It was really hard.
That's interesting. It's a deep cut because that's not even a song that was a single. So like, yeah, I'm curious. You're picking songs that most of these, I think, were radio singles, but that's a song that never...
I just love that song. And I love the theology in that song. I can't help it.
I'm the author and I like it, so it's in.
It's then. Is that how it was?
I mean, there were a few that probably weren't, you know, the most popular songs, but they were just so good that we couldn't help it.
I was going to say some of the Michael W. Smith, we didn't pick his two most famous songs, but just where we wanted to go theologically. Like, we know we've got to have Michael W. Smith songs, but we don't have maybe his most popular radio hits. That's an example. What were you going to say, Rachel?
I was going to say Lisa Bevel's No Condemnation is, you know, underrated gem. So I'm hoping people will hear this song for the first time and be like, man, this is an amazing song. I just love Lisa Bevel. Can't help it.
I appreciate that a lot because, like you said, you're doing some wide appeal names here, DC Talk, Stephen Curtis Chapman. Lisa Bevel, not so much. That's not so well known. And I love that because there were so many artists like that that flew under the radar or everybody else got the attention. But that's kind of what we said earlier. The 90s were this time of so much music explosion that it was easy to miss stuff like that. That was fantastic.
I was just going to say, you know, a really instrumental artist in my love of CCM was Susan Ashton, her first couple of CDs. We didn't do a Susan Ashton song, and I was listening to one of her CDs a couple of weeks ago in my office while I was studying. I'm like, man, how did we not do one of these songs? Or, you know, we don't do anything from FFH or PFR, which were huge. Like, it was really, really. And so if anyone's out there listening and you're a big FFH or PFR, don't scare that. Let that scare you away. I mean, but it was really, it's a hard task. Like, that just shows you how good the music was, because we had to, we couldn't pick everything we liked.
When you're going from genres from folk to like Lisa Bevel pop, like I think of her song Holding On. And in fact, she even brings Toby Mac into that first song on that album, that No Condemnation album, if I'm not mistaken.
So Chaperone, I think, Chaperone. Album before. But yeah, I mean, we've got everything from the W's to Cindy Morgan, Sandy Patty, to Kirk Franklin.
Yeah.
Stomp. Yeah. You guys do a thing about Stomp.
Did you ever get into any of the ska stuff, either personally or in the book? Because Scott was like one of those weird eras of the 90s.
The W's, we do have W's. Yeah. The Devil is Bad, which is just such a fun example of the variety of music that was available in the 90s. It was such a fun era. That's another thing I feel like is lost in today's Christian music, was just the silliness, the fun, not taking yourself so seriously. The W's, The Devil is Bad is a great example of that.
You go from, like, we talked about Stephen Curtis Chapman, you can pick these songs, Michael W. Smith, DC Talk, all these big songs. You pick a song from Rich Mullins. How do you decide to pick that? Like, you're like, Hold Me, Jesus.
Right.
That, for, I don't know if, like, for me, I fall in love with In America. I don't know what that's, his song In America is just, it's, it sounds like it's from Ireland, yet it's about America. I don't know. I'm just curious.
With Rich, you know, that was one of those, okay, that was a non-negotiable, that we've got to do a Rich Mullins song. And I don't know what caused us to choose Hold Me, Jesus. And it might have been me. I think I had an emotional attachment to that song. It was just one of those I can think of many times driving in my car in tears, thinking about the meaning of that song, that I had a spiritual, emotional attachment to it. And then as we studied the song, and Rachel and I had a discussion about it and researched it, you think about it, it's just going through tough times, and the song's actually about temptation. I'm like, whoa, this is, if there's anybody that's going to lay it out there, honestly, it's going to be Rich. And so, yeah, let's explore this one. And we do one other Rich Mullins song. It was just covered by Caveman's Call, Hope to Carry On, was a Rich song. So, yeah.
We could do a whole podcast. I'd love to do a whole podcast just on Rich Mullins, a fascinating, fascinating person. You kind of have referenced this a little bit. You know, we're talking all the fanboy, fangirl stuff of the 90s music, but what are some of the differences you see, or even the value in what the music was then as to what it is now, keeping in mind that's what we do for a living?
That's a really difficult question. I think that there's a lot of respect and admiration and appreciation for today's Christian artists, just like there was back then. You know, Christian music is a wonderful tool for the church. It's a wonderful tool for individuals to play that and to just be encouraged to meditate on scripture. It's really difficult to just say, well, today's Christian music's not my taste. I know that it's out there and you got to find it. Unfortunately, it's a little harder to find your favorites than it was in the 90s for whatever reason. But, you know, Christian music is something that's so important. I just hope that it continues to reach the young people a little bit more than it is today.
Sure. And you know, and I think a big part of that answer, and it feels so strange to say it, like everything is driven by a lot of the worship music now, which, again, is a great thing. We sing a lot of those songs in our church, and but it got to the point in the early 2000s where every artist, all right, now we're going to have a worship album. And then that kind of dictated the genre to a great degree, to where the creativity and the exploration wasn't happening, at least in my estimation. And so it's not that there weren't great worship songs being written. And I even love it. The pendulum always swings, and it's great to see people actually trying to put some deep theology in some of the current worship music. And that's an encouraging thing. I mean, it's great. Worship music is great, but just sometimes a lot of it does start sounding the same. I mean, yeah. Just to be honest, you know.
Is there an artist today that you relate with like you did in the 90s?
I love For King and Country. I still, and I think it's because they were along for the ride in the 90s. In case people don't know, that's Rebecca St. James's brothers. You know, they toured with her. They grew up with the same music, the same influences. I can't help but hear that in their music today. Even though their music is so different and fresh, I still hear the storytelling and the creativity that comes out in their music. Also like Apollo Limited, Riley Clemens. I love her. I mean, yeah, there's definitely some people that I relate to and appreciate.
Yeah. You know, I really like For King and Country, and so a little disclaimer, I wasn't as big a DC Talk fan in the 90s as Rachel was, but
he's over. We're done.
But I appreciated what they did. Again, I was a softie. I was listening to Point of Grace and For Him, but you know, you would hear them on mainstream. And now as I go back and listen to the Jesus Freak album, you can listen to it front to back. Like that album still stands up. So I get it. I would say now I'm more of a Toby Mac fan than I would have even thought to be in 1995. His latest album blows me away. I mean, and of course, so much of it is the writing, his heart, and the loss of his son. Me and my family went to see him in concert last year in Nashville. And what a performer. And you know the dude loves Jesus, and the songs are real. So I'm a bigger Toby Mac fan than I was in the 90s. And I would say I appreciate a lot of what Phil Wickham's doing. I really see a lot of depth in a lot of his current stuff that you can sing it on a Sunday. You know, it's worship stuff, but it kind of works for radio too. So he's got a good thing going on. I like what Phil's doing.
I'm curious from you, Ashley, because of the stuff you talk about in the 90s that you liked. Who was better? Clay Cross, Michael O'Brien, Scott Kerpane, Michael English.
I would say just a pure vocalist, Michael English, In Christ Alone was huge for me. Let's see, who is the first one you said?
Scott Kerpane.
Scott Kerpane, Clay Cross. He definitely had the best mullet.
Yeah.
which you know is part of the 90s too, so I've got to give him something.
So then I'll say, just on the flip side for Rachel, what's the best alternative band in the 90s for you? Would it have been Switchfoot, Sixpence None the Richer, because you referenced them, Ashley referenced them, PFR, or I'll throw out a really deep cut, Shaded Red.
That's really difficult. I would say that my daughter would answer Sixpence None the Richer. She's 13. She's a huge Sixpence fan now. I'm going to say Switchfoot.
Yeah. I wouldn't. Would you qualify PFR as alternative? I wouldn't.
No, I don't know. Like Beatles-esque.
I'm
a huge PFR fan.
Would Jars of Clay be considered alternative?
I think so.
Yeah.
See, I think so.
When their album,
Miller's Outpost. So, yes.
We've had this discussion, Rachel and I, and I remember like when their album came out, I felt like I was listening to the heaviest, craziest, most alternative stuff that I'd ever listened to. And I loved it. It was so good. That first album. So I know you didn't ask me the question, but I
would. No, Jars of Clay. I mean, totally.
I'm all about Jars of Clay's stuff in the 90s. It was so good.
So I feel like maybe one of the things we could cover from our end, and you guys may already know this, but we do talk a lot all the time, both on the air, on the podcast, just as friends, about this shift that we've referenced before, what Christian music is now, what it was in the 90s. And a big part of that, for anybody listening to this podcast that might be curious, we actually do have another podcast episode where we talk about some of the myths and stereotypes of Christian radio and music and how it happened, how we got here. But one of them is because at that time, we were the youth. Rachel, you made a point about the youth that really pushed it to youth groups, which brought a lot of variety to it. But as those songs were trying to make it to radio, something else came into radio that changed everything, and it was research. And there were consultants right around 2000 that started like, hey, you know what? Christian radio, which to be fair, was a little all over the map. I mean, it was inspo radio, and then it started to diversify. And then these consultants who had done radio stuff outside of Christian radio came in. They're like, okay, let's test songs and see what people think. And this is where you start getting, for example, your Cutlass worship album, which leads to everybody else's worship right. album. And those songs get on the radio, and it became a cycle which hasn't broken for 23 years, which is we test the songs. Oh, only those ones get the biggest response. And so other music starts to shift towards those songs because that's where the money is. That's where the airplay is. And that was a big part of why things shifted and kind of stayed shifted. Now, there's other subtle shifts within that, right? But that was a big part of kind of where we landed, where we are now, as opposed to this time of wild variety.
Well, you know, it's almost as if, you know, you've got a record executive that comes in with a band and said, all right, we need you to cut an album. This is what's selling right now. This is essentially what you're saying. And we need something that sounds like this. Well, as soon as they cut that album, well, that's what things sounded like 2 years ago. And in the 90s, there wasn't a record executive. We need you to sound this way. Everybody, it was the Wild Wild West, which is what made it so great. It wasn't a record executive saying, all right, Jars of Clay, y'all need to sound like DC Talk and Caveman's Call. We need you to sound like PFR. No, they were really doing their own thing, not just trying to follow a trend, which makes it so good.
Yeah. So it's kind of a weird cyclical thing how that's worked since then and how we've kind of stayed in a similar place. And the way people consume music has changed so much. So there's all these changes. But let me ask one thing, though, that you do mention in the book, because as I'm going through, tell us about the color vest and corny song correlation. What is this formula?
Well, in our scholarly observation, we observed that the more corny a song is, the more colorful the vest must be when performing it. It's called the corny song colorful vest correlation. I think that's what we named it.
Very scientific.
Yes. It's very scientific. Yes.
What is the corniest, most colorful song?
Or vest?
Well, a song that is both equally corny as it is colorful, if it's the same ratio, then it meets the qualifications for a Yeah Bud equilibrium, which was accomplished by Stephen Curtis Chapman in his song Got to Be True, which when he performs that song live in his Live Adventure VHS, he wears the most colorful vest possible, which matches the amount of corniness that is in the song. So,
yeah.
Is that based off of the era though? Cause it's the early 90s and like, that's where you get, I love rap music. And that's,
yes,
this is bright.
That was one of the songs that we included in the study actually.
Well, and I want to give a little disclaimer. So like if my seminary professors, like where I got my doctorate in biblical spirituality that I wrote a dissertation and, like, if any of them listen to this, the disclaimer is Rachel wrote the whole vest thing. I had nothing to do with that.
I don't know. You know,
hey, Joseph wore a colored vest.
It sounds
solid. That was all Rachel, and it honestly was. So, you know, I'm just, anyway.
Hey, no, I have a master's degree, and I took research methods in grad school.
It came out in that vest thing. Yep.
I mean, Rachel, it is meant to be ridiculous and silly. It is meant to be.
I would love to see from you like a post, or you should do like just an exclusive video showcasing some of the said vests. I think it's important that the world really understands.
It would be her daughters that would do the video for her probably.
Well, in the book, there's a feature where there's an actual a QR code where you can follow along and hear the songs in the devotional. And if you go and you follow the QR code, it takes you to our companion website. And we do list the music videos for these very corny songs that we discuss in the book. Yeah, one of them is like Brian Duncan's Don't You Want to Rap. We've got Monk W. Smith, Picture Perfect, I think, and a couple of others. Yeah, super corny. You got to see it for yourself.
Where does Take Me to Your Leader stand?
I think that's in a class all its own, really. It's so bizarre and out there. You know, Newsboys, Steve Taylor stuff. They're just in a class all its own.
That's true.
That's true.
Banner Man. Who's the artist? I mean, it's about songs and the lyrics in there and the theology. But is there an artist you wish you had in there?
I said earlier, Susan Ashton. For me,
I think I probably would pick Petra, not because they're my favorite, but because so many people love Petra.
Yeah, they were so huge in the beginning, and they tell a big part of the story. And you know, and there's some things that even got left out that if we ever do another volume, even some of the bands we didn't listen to, but even through social media, like the amount of Striper fans out there, and like there's just a whole world of that we can explore with this. So anyway,
well, and maybe we will end up seeing a continuation of Mixtape Theology. This was a lot of fun for us. We flipped through a whole bunch of the book. And I think anybody who also doesn't even know the music that well from the 90s, you weren't around it or, you know, whatever, weren't around at all at that time. There's also like, there's just some really fun cultural things you guys referenced throughout that happened in the 90s. A lot of that youth group culture, the WWJD bracelets, the purity rings, the human videos, all of that sort of stuff that was just
interpretive movement.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh man.
Yes.
We lived in separate states. But at the same time frame, Matt and I both had lip sync groups that toured. I toured the state of Arizona.
See, but you know what the big difference was? We did ours because we knew this is really funny and we do it like a talent show. Aaron actually thought it was cool.
It was.
And
Switchfoot opened up for us.
Yeah, he likes to say that. It doesn't make your human videos any cooler at all. Well, guys, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. Thank you for this book. This has just been so much fun for us, and I think for so many other people that remember that era well or want to be exposed to something that is just so wildly different than what we have right now for Christian culture and Christian music. Appreciate you joining us to talk about it.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Aaron.
Well, Consider It Joy is a production of 88.3 Life FM in Bakersfield, California. You can listen to us there every weekday on the 88.3 Life FM app. You can also find all the ways to listen and connect at ConsiderItJoyPodcast.com. Thank you for subscribing, for leaving those 5-star ratings on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and thank you for listening.